Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Hi, folks. I'm Jelaine Fenner, and welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today with our garden guy, Gary Heilig.
Hi, everybody.
And it's just Gary and I today. Tom is taking care of some family business. So Tom is going to miss this, I know. So that's what I talked to him earlier, and I said, you're going to have to listen to the program.
Well, yeah, he can hear it when we put it out there.
Right, because you mentioned you had stopped by his house. Tom does live right next to the studio here, and he put in a greenhouse, and Gary went and was checking it out today.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So we are going to be talking about November. What should we be doing for our gardens in November? And maybe depending if there's a lot of snow on the ground.
We could have snow by then.
Yeah. Okay, well, Gary, why don't you have a word of prayer for our program?
Okay. Our Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for the opportunity to speak about gardening, and we look forward to the day when we will return to a garden state here on this earth.
Amen.
We thank you so much for all the blessings you give us as we've had a beautiful gardening season. Maybe a few problems, but we're still thankful. We're also looking forward to that day when you'll return, mm-hmm. and we will be able to enjoy gardening without having to spray pesticides mm-hmm. or have diseases or insects. And we look forward to that day in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Okay, so we're talking about what we might need to be doing in our garden. Providing there's no snow, is it too late to clean up the garden?
No, and normally people would clean up the garden usually after everything dies out. We haven't had a killing frost yet down in our area. And it doesn't look like you've had one here either, but once everything has been killed off, then it's time to get in there and clean it out. And there's a couple of reasons you do that. One, when you have diseased plants, like Tom mm-hmm. was talking about some problems on his tomatoes, if you leave that material there, then there's a lot of what we call inoculum, which will help to start disease next year. And so it's nice to get that out of the garden. Another thing that we do it for is some insects like to be at a certain depth in the soil to overwinter, like squash vine borer, for instance. So I always like to till my garden after everything's cleaned out. So some of them will be pushed down deeper and some of them will be up closer to the surface, which decreases their chances of surviving. And another thing that you can do is get rid of all the perennial weeds. And one of the things I do at home is I buy, it's about 3 to 4 mil black plastic, and I just cover over the whole garden for the winter months. And what that does, if there are any perennial weeds there, it'll simply smother them. And then when you're ready to start planting, just peel back the plastic as you want to and till that area, and you have a weed-free area.
So
until you put the mulch down.
Okay, so we're recording this in October, so that's why maybe when you hear this, we haven't had any frost, because maybe by November we will have.
Oh, I'm sure we will by then.
But it's best once after the frost to really go in there and clean it out.
Mm-hmm.
And now when you're talking about tilling the garden, some of these bugs, they like to go down deep where they can survive during the winter?
Well, they have a preferred depth where they like to overwinter. Mm. And if they're too shallow or too deep, it lessens their chances of survival.
I see. Okay. All right. So then once you've already cleaned out, rototilled, whatever, it's a good idea to put the plastic down. Like you said, it will help to kill the perennial weeds.
Yeah, because when the plants are going into the winter months, they are still going to be using sugars that they stored up. Now, if you have perennial weeds that haven't been disturbed at all, like you didn't till, for instance, you can just put down the black plastic, and it will deny the light that they need mm-hmm. to make the sugars that will keep them alive during the winter months. And so in the spring, when they are normally emerging before you get out to the garden, they're still covered by the black plastic. Mm-hmm. So everything will just die under there, and you'll have bare soil.
So it's a good idea, really good idea, to put down this plastic.
If you would like to help control weeds, and what we like to do is when we're getting ready to plant, we'll leave everything covered, then we'll pull off the plastic in the area we want to work mm-hmm. only, then we'll put those plants there, then we'll put our mulches down so that the weeds never really have a chance to get going, because you spend most of your time in the garden dealing with weeds.
Yes, isn't that the truth? So, okay, is it a special plastic that people use?
Just the black plastic that you pick up at Home Depot, Menards, or Lowe's, and it's a fairly thick plastic. And the last time I checked, it's not real cheap, but for about 1,000 square feet, which is the biggest one that they sell, it's around $80 or so.
Okay. But that covers quite, I mean, you think 1,000 square feet, that's not a bad size.
Yeah, that's pretty good. But also I look at how much time am I going to spend? I'll spend the $80 and not have to deal with all the weeds.
Yeah. So that's return on your money, right?
Yeah, because you also don't have to go out and buy weed killers. Right. You can use that plastic for multiple years if you roll it up after not used it and kept it out of the sun.
Okay. All right. Well, let's talk about pruning ever-bearing raspberries.
Okay. We have two different types of raspberries. We have the summer-bearing raspberries, which produce around July, and then we have the ever-bearing, which is kind of a misnomer because they basically produce their first crop on what we call the primo canes, which are the canes that grow in the current season. Then they die back a little bit during the winter, and they will produce a second smaller crop during July when the regular summer-bearing raspberries produce. So if a person is going to only get the fall crop, then in the fall, what you would do is cut down all the canes and clean out the bed, and you cut them right down to the ground. That means you would only have raspberries late summer going into the fall the following season. That's a single crop, even though you have
ever-bearing
raspberries. The other thing you could do is wait until the spring and then just prune back those primo canes as far back as they've died, and they will produce that second crop. Now, the summer-bearing raspberries, when they produce on their second-year-old canes, they're not going to produce again on those canes. So during the late fall, early winter, you can go in there and take those out, because in the spring there's a lot of stuff to do. So if you can do some of the work at a time when the workload is lower, then that's a good time to cut down those canes on the summer-bearing ones too.
But so if they don't get to it in the fall, they would have to want to cut them in the spring.
You should, because if you leave dead canes there, it increases the chance of certain diseases.
Okay. All right. And so when you're saying ever-bearing, even though they're ever-bearing raspberries, depending how they take care of them, they might only produce one crop.
Right. How you want to crop it. What I used to do before the spotted wing Drosophila, which we've talked about before, is I would only fall crop my raspberries, even though they were ever-bearers, because during the summer months, there were more insect problems with the raspberries. And if I waited and just had the crop in the fall, there were fewer insects, and you could get away with not spraying them at all and not have any big problems, especially if you were doing all the other cultural things that kept the raspberries healthy so you weren't getting diseases. But once we got the spotted wing Drosophila, they start to build up in the summer, and by the fall, they're pretty high numbers, and now they will be in those fall raspberries if you don't spray them. So you can't just crop them once a year in order to prevent certain insect problems.
And you have to spray to get rid of this insect.
Well, you don't have to spray if you don't mind eating some insects. I mean, you're going to be eating some small maggots. There's no doubt about that.
Now, that doesn't sound very appetizing.
No, not to me anyway.
Yeah. Okay, well, since we're talking about pruning, what other things should we be pruning this time of year?
Well, one of the things is if you've had fire blight, which is a bacterial disease, in, say, your apples or pears, when you get into the cold weather, then that should be pruned out. And if you don't, fire blight will just keep moving down the branches until it gets to the trunk, and it can kill a tree completely. So I have a pear tree right now that fire blight has gotten into, and that's one of the things I'll be doing this fall, is cutting that out. And you can tell if you have fire blight because the wood will be discolored and slightly shrunken. It almost turns black. And what you do when you follow those physical symptoms that you can see on the branch, when you see the end of it, then you go down another 12 to 14 inches and make your cut there.
Okay.
And hopefully it's not going to be into a major branch.
I was going to say, you might be cutting you know, some branches, and right?
You just do the best you can, and if the fire blight's already gone past that point, well, you're just out of luck.
It's going to kill the tree anyways, you said.
Right, and also on oaks, we're into the cold period, so if you prune during that time, then you won't spread something called oak wilt, which is also a threat to certain oaks. And then, of course, anytime you have something that's dead on a tree, that can be pruned out anytime.
Okay, so, yeah, because lots of times you'll see dead branches and you want to get rid of them. Mm-hmm. I have a question about oaks, the acorns. This year, because we have a couple of oak trees and we have a house by Lake Mitchell, and the acorns, I mean, unbelievable this year. I've never seen so many acorns. And all summer long. Mm-hmm. And my neighbor, who's lived there like over 40 years, that's what she said. She'd never seen this many. And there's, I don't know if it's an old wives' tale, that when there's lots of acorns, it's going to be a bad winter. Is there anything truth to that?
No. the reason why plants, especially trees, will set heavy crops of seed is it usually indicates they've been stressed in some way. For instance, when we have a dry summer, plants tend to set very heavy seed crops the following year. Mm. And it might last for more than 1 year. After the drought of 1988, we saw all kinds of stress symptoms that played out on trees for about 3 or 4 years the event. If you have pine trees, for instance, you'll notice that the needles will turn yellow toward the middle of the tree. And I used to get calls, people think that their trees were dying, when actually what it was is a very dry summer. And that process of needle drop would happen over a very short period of time.
Oh, okay.
So when a tree sets heavy seed, it usually means something stressed it, especially if it's a wide area, then you know it's weather-related.
Okay, yeah, well, that was, I mean, it's just, it was terrible this year, all these acorns falling off the trees.
Well, that depends on your perspective. If you're a squirrel, you're saying yahoo.
Yeah, well, there was lots of them. Okay, so, well, let's go back to berries. What about strawberries? You need to cover them?
The reason we suggest people cover strawberries is because strawberries have a very shallow root system. About 90% of the roots are in the top 6 inches of the soil. And if you're on a heavier textured soil especially, we go through these freezing and thawing cycles in the fall. What that does is when you have a freeze, the ice expands the soil. When it melts, it contracts. And that freezing and thawing cycle can actually break very fine roots on strawberries. You will notice a difference on the quality of the plants coming out of dormancy when they're covered versus non-covered. Mm. So now if you're on a light sandy soil where water moves down through very easily, it's not as critical. But the plants aren't covered to keep them warm. It's a matter of protecting them from the freezing and thawing cycle. So the time that we normally will cover them is when the temperatures drop down to about 20 degrees. A good visual sign would be when it gets cold enough so that the leaves fall flat to the ground. And once they're flat to the ground, it's time to put on your mulch. And we normally try to use a clean straw, and we put it up to 4 inches thick. That's about all you're going to need. And I like to put it on just before a rain, because when a rain wets it, it stays in mm-hmm. place. If it's dry and windy, it blows mm-hmm. all over the garden.
Right. Okay. Okay, so what about lawn seeding? This is November. If you don't have any snow, is it a good time to seed the lawn?
Well, even if you have a light snow, you might still be able to pull it off. But ideal time for starting a lawn, we said earlier, was mid-August to mid-September. But there is another time that you can sow seed. It's called a dormant seeding, which means you're putting the seed down and there's no chance that it's going to germinate, which is usually around mid-November or so, and later, depending on how much snow we have on the ground. Ideally, you'd like to have no snow, but if it was just a light dusting, you can probably still get away with it. And the best way to do it would be use an overseeder.
Okay.
And the overseeder, what it does is it actually puts these horizontal lines or little strips of lines, and then it drops the seed in there, so you get good seed-to-soil contact. and the seed will sit there until spring, unless you have grubs. If there are grubs there and they're still active, they will eat the seed. So,
all right. So, yeah. Well, how do you get rid of grubs then this time of year if they're still active?
It would have to be fairly warm. Mm-hmm. Now, you have to realize that the soil temperature drops more slowly than the air temperature.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So if, say, for instance, the soil temperature is 60 or higher, they're probably still going to be active.
Okay.
When it starts to drop, they slow down. And if you do still have some grubs and they're still actively feeding, then there are two products that you can put down. One is called Dilox, and the other is called 7. And it's 7 granular, not the stuff that you would use in a vegetable garden.
Okay. Now, how do you take the temperature of the soil?
You can buy soil thermometers from local garden centers, or you can find them at Ace Hardware. They're not expensive at all. And you basically want to take the soil temperature at about a half inch to an inch.
Okay. What about if you still have unplanted bulbs? Is it okay to plant them now?
And this is a question I used to get on a regular basis, usually starting in November and extending into March. And basically you have to think about, a bulb is like a little battery. It has so much energy in it for that plant to grow. And if it's not planted, it's still using that energy. So essentially it's consuming itself. Mm. And you reach the point where the bulb just dies and fritters or rots away, it dry mm-hmm. rots away. So it's always best, if you can still plant it in November, it's going to do better in the ground than it's going to do sitting around.
Okay.
Now, if you can't put it in the ground, then the next best thing would be to put it in a pot.
Oh, okay.
And bulbs have to go through a certain chilling period in order for them to start to grow. So you could put them in a pot and store them in your basement or some really cool place around 40 degrees, and they'll get that chilling period. Then you can plant it out in the spring, and it will still produce a flower. But if you can't do that, if you were to put it in a pot and put it in the garage where it got really cold, it's possible it could freeze and be destroyed. So you will have to protect it a little bit if you can't get it in the ground.
Okay. Now, what about preparing roses for the winter?
Yeah, there are a couple of things about roses. A lot of times people used to call me and say, my roses died during the winter months. And they want to know, was it the cold temperature? Maybe, maybe not. It would have to be really cold to kill the roses outright. Mm. But what usually takes the roses out is people don't control during the season black spot. And, of course, all the leaves fall off prematurely. They don't store enough sugars. And they essentially starve to death during the winter. But assuming that you have pretty healthy plants, what people like to do is they like to buy these rose cones, and then they cut their roses down to get under the cone. That's okay if you have a large cone, but if you have a nice, healthy, tall rose, I want to remove as little of the tissue as I can. So what I used to do is I would just bring in something to mulch around the graft union of the rose. That's where the rose was grafted. And that's usually right at ground level. And I want to insulate that. And so I'll pile something like peat or even soil, but don't take it away from around the roots. Bring it in from somewhere else. And pile it up about a foot over the graft union. And then don't do anything to the top section.
Really? Okay.
The reason for that is you're always going to have some dieback. But it may only be 3 or 4 inches. Mm. So if you have dieback of 3 or 4 inches on a 3-foot rose, that rose is going to have more energy to get started in the spring.
Ah.
Now, if I have a small rose cone that's only about 16 inches and I have a 3-foot rose and I cut it down to get under that little rose cone, then I've really reduced the ability of that plant to get up and go next spring. So unless it's a really unusually cold winter, which we don't have them that often now, then you're better off just covering the graft union.
By the soil. And you said about 12 inches up, maybe?
Yeah, about 12 inches high. And the other thing I would caution you against doing, and we did this once at Michigan State University and worked in the old horticulture gardens. We put cages around the roses and then filled them in with straw. What do you think that did?
I don't know.
It attracted rodents. It was a perfect place. And guess what they use for food?
Yeah.
The roses. So they girdled all the roses, and we had to pull them all out.
So, yeah, you don't want to do that.
No, okay. Bad idea.
All right, well, folks, stay tuned. We got to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with the Garden Guy.
The Bible and God's character are under attack like never before. Here at Strong Tower Radio, we are proud to hold up the Bible as a lamp unto our feet and a light unto our path. We believe the Bible is the Word of God and contains the good news of God's character and His great plan of salvation for mankind. If you know and believe this to be true, won't you help Strong Tower Radio proclaim the truth about our God and His Word, the Bible? To do that, go to www.strongtowerradio.org, and there, on our secure website, you will find a donate button. Click on that and give as the Lord directs. Thank you for listening and supporting Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
Hi, folks. I'm Jelaine Fenner, and welcome back to the Strong Tower Radio Today program. And I am with Gary Heilig. Hi, Gary.
Hey, how's it going out there?
And he is our garden guy. And Tom is off taking care of some family business. So it's just Gary and I today. And we're talking about November, what to be doing in your garden. And so let's talk about storing sprays and pesticides. What are we supposed to be doing this time of year?
Well, if you have something that's a powder, as long as it stays dry, you're okay. But liquids, they can freeze depending on what's in them. And so it's a good idea to move those into a location where they're not exposed to temperature extremes. And usually people will put them in their basement. So about this time, I'll get all the liquids and I'll take them down to the basement and store them someplace where nobody can get into them. Of course, if you have small children, you might want to lock them up.
Right. But anything that's a powder, as long as it stays dry.
As long as it stays dry. Like not only fertilizers, chemicals, all of those types of things, they should be dry.
Okay. All right. And
The other thing with sprayers, if you just have a compressed air pump sprayer, you have no problem. But if you have one of these sprayers that run off of a battery, like a lawnmower battery, and talking about lawn tractors here, and it's a diaphragm pump, you do not want to leave that in the garage with water in it.
Because it'll freeze.
It'll freeze and it'll destroy the diaphragm pump. You'll get 1 year out of it. Mm. So what you should do is take that diaphragm pump off and store that down the basement too to protect it.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about our evergreen trees, you know, and because they should be very hardy and take the winter.
they will, but there are some things that can cause some problems for evergreens. For instance, deer like to browse on certain evergreens, and you can either put up a physical barrier, or there are some deer repellents like Deer Away that you can use, and you can make your own also. For instance, you can take an egg, break it into a plastic milk container, and if you want to, you can break it up first, fill that with water, and put about a tablespoon of oil in it or a spreader sticker that you can buy from a garden center. And you can let that sit for a few days, and then you can spray that on your ornamentals, and that helps to keep the deer away. It's very similar to what's in what's called Deer Away.
Using an egg and water, and what else did you say?
A tablespoon of oil, just a vegetable oil. That's like the spreader sticker, but you can buy spreader stickers that you mix with chemicals to help materials stay on the leaves. But if you don't want to buy that, then you can just use an oil, just some vegetable oil.
So is it a deer repellent?
Yeah, it keeps the deer from feeding on the plant.
So they don't like the smell, the taste?
No, they don't like it. And if there's two ways you can do it. You can apply it just as it is, or you can let it marinate for a while, which gives it a little different smell. And after about a week or so, you can put that on, and it'll keep the deer off.
Now, I've heard human urine will keep the deer away.
Well, also people have used predator urine and things like that. It depends. Human hair may or may not work because all human hair is not the same because people spray different things into it. Other people don't put anything in their hair and it doesn't have that much of a smell, especially if you're washing it on a regular basis. So it's the scent of humans that deer don't particularly care for. But if people are feeding them, they're probably used to being around people anyway.
Oh, sure.
The other thing, evergreens, especially if they're near a road, they might be susceptible to salt sprays. And it might be a good idea to put up a barrier to keep those salt sprays from getting onto your plants because it can cause some damage also. Another thing that you can have a problem with on ornamentals, especially young ones, is rodent damage. And we're specifically talking about field mice. And the best way to deal with those, if it's a single trunk plant, you can just make a little cage that goes up about 2 or 3 feet. Or if it's a single stem trunk of a young tree, there are plastic wraps that you can put on it. But if you don't protect them, you might find newly planted trees and certain shrubs will have feeding from rodents and they can destroy them.
Okay, so even putting plastic, because I know when I've had mice in my house, they seem to chew through some of the plastic to get to the food that's in there.
Yeah, are you talking about the garage or the house itself?
The house.
Yeah, now a plastic bag is no barrier for a mouse. Now, if you have harder, thicker plastic, like a plastic container, then they can't get through that. And you also have to realize that as it gets colder, various rodents start to migrate into living
Right, where it's warmer.
Yeah, dwelling places, if they can get in. So there are ways that you can mouse-proof your house. And it's important that you think about, and you really need to think like a mouse. They don't need much space to get in. Something as small as a nickel, they can squeeze through that. So if, for instance, if you leave your garage door open and you have an attached garage, I guarantee you there's probably a way for a mouse to get in that garage and go into the attic and find its way all through your house and walls. And you just have to make sure those doors are closed, that the gaps are filled. You have areas where pipes or wires are going into the house. Those have to be sealed. And what I do, and I live out in the country, I will put mouse baits in the areas where they can come in, like in our underground garage, so that as soon as they come there, there's a bait there for them. And we usually take them out the first few weeks of the fall. But they can get into everything.
Right, they can, especially if they get into your house.
Yeah, my wife had to throw out a lot of material in the basement because they get in there and they make a nest and they do their business there, and it's just terrible.
I know it. If they want to stay outside, they can stay outside. But once they get in my house, I am not happy about it. And I can see, I'm more of a dog person than a cat, but I can see the advantages to having a cat.
No, only if the cat is not a bougie cat.
Yeah, well.
A cat that's so well fed that he's not going to bother with a rodent.
That's right, Well, on the farm, we have farm cats. So
okay, now that's
we don't feed them. I mean, we do feed them a little bit of cat food, but pretty much they're on their own.
Yeah, those guys will go after rodents.
Okay. All right, well, talking about evergreens again, like, you know, let's talk about why do you see people tie up the limbs?
Well, on certain evergreens, when you get a heavy snow, especially a heavy wet snow, the limbs will bend over, and if they're there for a long period of time, they don't go back up very easily, and they may stay in that position. So if you have something like that, then you may want to tie it up so that if you do get a heavy snow, those limbs won't fall over.
Okay. Because, you'll see them, especially when there's lots of snow.
Mm-hmm. And you could do that. If you're also trying to protect them from salt spray, you could just use burlap and wrap it around it, and you'll actually get two things done.
Right. Well, you see a lot of times around, the landscaping around people's houses, they do the burlap.
Yeah.
And so that's more to protect the limbs, like from the snow and the ice?
It could be that, or it could be there as a barrier to keep deer from feeding on it, or it might be salt protection. There's a number of different reasons why people would wrap them.
Now, when you bring up about the salt, it just dawned on me then, well, maybe I don't want to be planting some of my nice trees near the road.
That's true. Now, I remember a guy that had an orchard, and he was far enough back from the road, but he was right along a busy county road, and the large snow throwers would come by there, the trucks, and they would just throw the salt and water spray all over his trees, and the trees were a good 40, 50 feet away from the road.
Wow.
And it caused serious problems because apple trees don't like salt sprays. So sometimes you can't do anything about it because the landscape material might already be there when you buy the house.
Mm-hmm.
But you do have to be aware if you have something that is susceptible to salt damage.
Okay. Well, let's talk about equipment maintenance, because I know being a farm on a farm in the wintertime is when they're always working on it. Well, I take that back. They work on equipment all year round because something always breaks down. But,
I know about that.
But the wintertime is maybe you spend a lot more time doing maintenance.
Well, a lot of times when people get to the end of the year, they're tired of mowing the grass and they just want to park the lawnmower, not worry about it anymore. But in the spring, you need to have it ready to go. So it's a good idea to change the air filter. It's a good idea to check the belts to see if anything's worn, both the dry belt and the dry belt for the mower deck if you happen to have a riding type mower. Change the oil, change the blades, because most people don't change blades very often. You should change them at least once or twice a year, especially if you hit a lot of rocks. So if you get all those things done at a time when there's not a lot to do outside, then basically all you have to do is put gas in your mower in the spring. It has oil and everything, and you're ready to go.
So what about, though, you parked the lawnmower, and it still had some gas in it?
Well, gas will last up to 2 years.
Okay.
And there are things that you can put in the gas tank. It's called a fuel stabilizer. But I have not put fuel stabilizers in them. So I'd come up in the spring and it starts just fine.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not sitting long enough to have to worry about that. So it's a good idea to at least take care of those types of things that you need to do on maintenance. The same thing with tillers. They need to, maybe you have to change the tines if you have like a Troy-Bilt tiller or something. And they have air filters, and there's all kinds of stuff that needs to be done. But if you don't do this and you want to take it in, it's better to do it in the fall because they just don't have the demand that
they
do in the spring. And you won't have to wait as long to get it back.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, what about, you talked about changing the blades. Do they ever sharpen blades?
That's what I meant by changing the blades. The reason I said changing is because I usually have three sets of blades at home, and I just have to change them because I keep them all sharp and ready to go. Because I have to travel quite a ways to get to the place that takes care of my mower. And if you only have one set of blades, then yes, they need to be sharpened and balanced.
Okay.
And usually, yeah, that's not very expensive. I think it's about $12 for what I have done.
So, but it sounds like it might be best to have at least an extra set. Mm-hmm. So you've always got, you can just take them off, put on the
quick change, and you're back in business very fast.
Yeah. And it's real important to have sharp blades, isn't it, to cut the grass?
Yeah, because when you cut grass with dull blades, it actually rips the grass. And,
instead of cutting it.
Right. And what you will see is kind of a grayish to straw color top on the grass, and that's from just ripping it.
Right, and so it's better to
it just doesn't
cut.
Look as good. Plus, you're more likely to get problems
because
it's not a clean cut.
All right, excuse me. What about compost piling maintenance? I mean, because lots of us have compost.
Mm-hmm. Well, we talked about building the compost pile back in, I think it was October. And so it's been breaking down for quite some time now. And if you haven't turned it, it's a good idea to turn it to reintroduce some oxygen into it. And if the pile is dry, you should moisten it because the bacteria work most efficiently when the pile is moist. Now, even though the air temperature is cold, there are different types of bacteria that are working. So we have the sacrophilic bacteria, the mesophilic bacteria, and then the thermophilic bacteria. So for instance, when the pile gets to be over 100 degrees, it's the thermophiles that are the dominant bacteria that are working. But the sacrophilic bacteria work at very low temperatures. So it can be 0 degrees outside, and they're still working and breaking down that pile. But they all need oxygen in order to carry that process on. And if it gets really packed down, and especially if you get a lot of rain and there are not a lot of air pockets in there, then it goes to what we call anaerobic, which means that the aerobic bacteria, the oxygen-loving bacteria, decrease in numbers, and the ones that work in low-oxygen environments increase. And what they do is they give off other gases. So, for instance, the aerobic bacteria basically produce carbon dioxide, which you can't really smell. And then the anaerobic bacteria produce hydrogen sulfide, which smells like a septic tank. So, okay. Which one do you want?
But either is still okay to put on the ground. Is that what you're saying? It just
Even if a pile goes anaerobic, there are some advantages to anaerobic pile in that since you don't have so much oxygen, you don't have water running through the pile, and you don't have leaching of nutrients as fast. Mm-hmm. So the compost will still be good. It's just that the pile can be unpleasant when you start to turn it if it's become anaerobic.
Okay.
And if you're in an area of what I call close quarter neighborhoods, your neighbors aren't going to appreciate that. And in certain areas, if you have anaerobic piles and you don't correct it, the authorities, the government, will make you tear the pile out.
Really?
But that's in areas that are really picky about those sorts of things.
Well,
in the country, don't worry about it.
The smell, yeah.
Yeah.
But you need to turn over your compost pile, and that helps because it gets more oxygen.
It'll help it to break down, and, it gets more oxygen. It speeds up the process of decomposition.
Okay. So usually in the fall, it seems to rain quite a bit. And then now getting into November, you might have snow, so it's getting the moisture usually.
Yeah, you're getting the moisture when it gets colder. Now, if it's really cold and the pile's kind of frozen, then just leave it alone.
Okay.
But if it's still warm enough for you to turn it and you're interested in getting your compost faster, then turning it will help. I mean, compost happens no matter what you do.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole process of having the right carbon to nitrogen ratio, and that's the materials that are high in carbon and high in nitrogen, moisture levels, particle size of pile, all of those things help to speed up the process. But if you do nothing but just pile stuff somewhere, it's going to break down eventually. It'll take about 2 years, but it'll break down.
Okay. Because most people have no idea how much nutrients are in it, or the carbon or whatever. Mm-hmm. They're just,
Yeah. We used to run test on compost to find out the nutrient content. Usually we're in the single digits in terms of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. So it would not be classified as a fertilizer per se. It's more what we call a soil amendment.
Okay.
But you do get some nutrients from compost.
Okay. I'm sorry. I'm going to have to be editing this. Let's talk about, we just have a couple minutes left in this segment, about storing produce that we've harvested and now we're putting it in the root cellar, because it should be always stored somewhere where it's rather cool, right?
It depends on what it is, but most things prefer cool. There are a couple of things you want to remember. Things that aren't treated with a lot of fungicides rot quickly. So, for instance, if you have potatoes that you've dug up, hopefully they've been somewhat cleaned off. And you need to go through and look, because they will start to rot. And once one rots, it can cause the others to rot.
Let me just ask then about potatoes, because, they're dirty.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good to wash them or wait and, try to get off some of the dirt and then wash them when you're ready to use them?
Well, if you have potatoes that have soil on them, they also have the precursors for breaking down, because there are all kinds of fungi and bacteria in that soil. So it's a good idea to at least wash off the extra dirt. You don't have to scrub them like you would see in a store. but you want to wash off some of that extra dirt. Make sure that the potatoes have a chance to dry first out of the sun, and then store them.
Okay,
cool,
so you,
and dry.
You wash them off and just let, like, you're letting them sit and dry.
Right. You don't want them to sit in the sun, though,
right,
because they'll start to turn green.
Right.
So put them in the shade somewhere. And then after they've dried off, which only be a few hours, then store them. And then check them every now and then. The same thing with pumpkins or squash. You'll have some that'll start to rot, and those need to be separated from the others. And, of course, you don't want to store anything that produces ethylene with any of your garden produce, because ethylene will speed up the rotting process.
So how do you know if something is ethylene?
Everything gives off ethylene, but fruits like apples, for instance, give it off a lot. When you smell the smell of an apple, you're mainly smelling ethylene with a lot of other chemicals in there too. So if you were to store a bunch of apples next to, say, pumpkins or squash, pumpkins and squash are going to rot a lot faster.
Okay, so it's better to, like, make sure they're separate.
Mm-hmm. Now, if a tomato is exposed to ethylene, let's say, for instance, you were going to get a frost and you picked all your green tomatoes and you were storing those, if those were stored near apples, it'll speed up the ripening process. They'll turn red faster.
Okay, so there's good and bad.
Yeah, I mean, it's a naturally occurring plant hormone, and at the right time, it can be useful, but too much of it can cause problems.
Okay. All right, well, folks, it's time for us to take another quick break, but stay tuned. We'll be right back with more of The Garden Guy. Do you want an easy way to support Strong Tar Radio, and it won't cost you anything? If you shop Amazon, you can set up your account to have them donate to us. Just go to smile.amazon.com and pick Strong Tower Radio as your charitable organization, and they will donate 0.5% of the eligible purchase to us. That's smile.amazon.com. And you can do more to support Strong Tower Radio by going to strongtowerradio.org and hit the donate button and become a monthly covenant partner. Remember, every little bit helps. We should do all in our power to spread the three angels' messages of Revelation 14, 6 through 12. Hi, folks. I'm Jelaine Fenner, and welcome back to Strong Tower Radio today with the Garden Guy, Gary Heilig.
I'm still here.
Yes. And we've been talking about things to do in November, especially if there's not been a lot of snow, what we can do. And there, there's all kinds of things besides maintenance and taking care of pruning. But let's talk about houseplant care and problems, Gary.
Well, a lot of people like to keep their houseplants outside during the summer because they grow really well.
Mm-hmm.
But when you bring them in, you can bring in stuff like aphids or spider mites. And so around November, you start to notice these things because their populations are exploding because there are no predators to go after them. So you should check your houseplants to make sure that you haven't brought any problems in.
But you need to do that before you bring them in, or like put them in the garage for a day or two and check them?
It's a good idea to treat things before you bring them in, because most likely they're going to have something on them. But a lot of times people just bring in their plants because they don't see anything. They really have to check closely for aphids and mites. And so around November is when the numbers start to explode because, as I said, there are no predators and it's nice and warm, it doesn't rain. And so you need to check those things and treat them if necessary. Also, since we're in a time of the year where we have lower light levels and things aren't actively growing as much, you need to cut off the fertilizer or at least reduce it. I normally don't fertilize my houseplants more than once a month or every 6 weeks during the winter months. And also, in a lot of cases, you need to reduce watering depending on what type of plant it is. If certain plants, for instance, if you give them too much water, they can't get rid of it and the cells will actually rupture. And then you get this scaling on the leaves, and it's called edema. And it's just simply giving them too much water for the conditions that they have. So you have to kind of adjust to the situation. Now, if you happen to have really nice plant lights and you're keeping them on for, say, 14 to 16 hours, which is like what we would see during the summer months, and you want to keep things growing, then yes, you can continue your fertilizing. The watering depends on what the humidity is in your house and how warm it is as to how often you'll have to water.
But so you do how need do you, adjust. So how do you decide, though? I mean, if the soil's... You want to keep it a little moist or you want it more dry?
It really depends on what plant. For instance, ferns tend to like to keep an evenly moist soil, whereas if you want to get to the other extreme, succulents like to stay on the dry side, like cacti and things of that sort. So you really have to know what type of plant you have. And if you're not sure, there's plenty of information on the internet telling you how to care for a specific type of a houseplant.
So what happens, because I'm not always good at watering, and I'll say, look how dry it is. I better water it. So I water it and it gets nice and moist.
Well,
but then I forget again, so.
It depends on how long it is that you forget, because a plant, when it doesn't have enough water, has what's called a wilting point, and that means it starts to droop. When it's starting to do that, you need to water. But if it stays in a droopy condition for days on end, you get to a point where watering is not going to help anymore.
It's going to just die.
It's just going to die.
So that's a good sign, though. As soon as it starts to kind of drooping, wilting, you're seeing
beginning to droop a little bit. The thing that I tell people, there's no such thing as a green thumb. It's learning what a plant needs and just paying attention.
Because every plant is different, you just said.
Right. I mean, what would happen if your children forgot your children to feed them?
Yeah.
They start to wilt and droop. so we have to give them nourishment. Yeah. And it's the same thing with plants. You just have to get to know that particular plant and give it what it needs, and then it'll be happy.
Okay. Well, let's talk about chrysanthemums. Is that how you say that?
Chrysanthemums.
Okay. Chrysanthemums. Okay. They're nice, beautiful plants that, you know, they can get very big and tall.
Yeah.
Right? Wide and tall.
Yeah. When you go to the garden centers in the fall, you'll see pumpkins and chrysanthemums. And it's one of the latest blooming plants that we have. And we put them in the ground in the fall, and then after the flowers have died completely, then we normally trim them back to about 4 to 6 inches. And we're basically getting them ready for the winter months. That's all you really have to do. And if you take care of them properly, they should come back the following season. You'll have to do some fertilizing. But after that, they'll bloom on their own when the weather is appropriate, which is in the fall.
But they can get so wide. I mean, they just keep...
Well, I mean, the horticulturists have come up with varieties that have gotten very vigorous, bigger flowers, wider plants. It really depends on the particular cultivar as to how big they get.
Now, so can you take them and, you know, prune them, or whatever you might do to transplant them somewhere else or give them to somebody else to put in their gardens?
You probably could get away with dividing them.
And when would you do that, though?
Oh, I guess if I was going to do something like that, I would wait for the plant to be in the ground at least 1 year, and then after it flowers the following year, then I would transplant it.
Okay.
Because the first year you plant it, you want the plant to get established.
Right, right. Okay, but does it matter what time of the year if you did it in the spring or the fall?
You probably could get away with it in the spring, too, but you'd have to get it just as it was beginning to grow.
Okay.
You might have some wilting in the plant when you do that, but you probably could get away with it. You could also start the plant by what we call softwood cuttings. And a softwood cutting is when the new growth comes up, you cut a section maybe 2 to 3 inches long, peel off the lower leaves, make a 45-degree angle cut right below where the leaf was attached, and then dip that in a rooting hormone and put it in a mixture of vermiculite and perlite 50-50 and put it in a container that has a cover over it and keep it moist, and you'll get plants by rooting.
Oh, okay.
So that's another option, too.
And what time of year is that a good thing to do?
As soon as you're getting the new growth.
Okay.
And we're talking about June.
Okay, so
that's a good time to do it.
All right. Okay. Now, what about getting soil samples? Does it matter what time of year?
Well, again, the soil lab that does soil testing wherever you go is not going to be as busy in the fall as it is in the spring because the farmers are bringing in a lot of soil tests. They're doing that now, too, to avoid the rush. But another reason for doing it is you can get your recommendations back, and then you can purchase your material so you won't have to wait in the spring for a soil test result to come back in order to get started in your garden. So yeah, it's a good time to do it this time of year. And any time that the soil is soft that you can get out there and dig, you can take a soil test or soil sample. Now, Michigan State, if you go through them, they have a self-mailer that you buy. You can go to the MSU, it's called MSU Stores, bookstore, and they have the kit there. Or you can go to your local extension office. They usually will carry them there. And, I mean, I've taken soil samples in December if the soil's not frozen, so.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then, so, like, I know around here a lot of people will go to the extension office, mm-hmm. and they get that, and then they mail it in somewhere?
Yeah, they give you complete instructions on how to take the samples and everything. You mail it back to Michigan State University. They do the test on the soil, and then they send you an email with the results.
Okay.
And then they direct you to a website that will tell you how to calculate what you need. And if you just don't understand all of those things, which some people won't because it's soil science, you can call the extension office and they should be able to give you some assistance.
Okay. And almost every county has their own extension or some of them?
Just about every county. I think in the Upper Peninsula there's one office that covers two counties.
Okay.
Okay. There's a presence in every county.
Are they all called Michigan State Extension?
Mm-hmm.
Or, okay, that's what I was thinking. All right, well, let's talk about ornamental grasses.
Now, at the end of the season, ornamental grasses, you have two choices. You can leave them up if you want the winter interest, which a lot of people do.
Now, what do you mean?
When we talk about winter interest, during the winter months, ornamental grasses can look attractive still. They may not be green, but some of them look nice while they're still dead. But in the spring, they have to be cut down. They're usually cut down to about 6 or 8 inches, depending on what type of ornamental grass it is. But if you don't really want the winter interest, you don't really care about that, then you can cut this down in the fall, and it'll be ready to go in the spring. And I try to get people to do as much as you can in the fall because there's so many things to do in the spring. I'm dealing with my vegetable garden. I'm pruning fruit trees. I'm raising transplants for my vegetable garden. You're getting ready to do things for the lawn, and there's just too much to do. So whatever you can do in the fall would be helpful.
So ornamental grasses, what's the advantage to having them? I mean, is it?
Well, it's just a different plant that you can have in the landscape. A lot of times people will mix ornamental grasses in with flowers. They have different shapes, textures. The colors don't vary that much. They're various shades of green or maybe a little blue-green. There's some grasses that have tinges of red in them. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times people use them for texture in the landscape.
To just aesthetic value.
Yeah.
Is that kind
of
it?
They don't. They're not edible. Wildlife doesn't bother it. Mm. Birds don't nest in it. I mean, they just don't have much use for other things other than aesthetic value.
Okay. And there's all kinds of different oriental grasses.
Ornamental grasses, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
Many different times. There's some that may be as small as 12 inches or so, and then you have some that'll be 4 to 6 feet.
Right. That's what I think of. I think of those great big tall mm-hmm. things that grow.
On Michigan State University's campus at the Turf Hancock Center, they have a big display of ornamental grasses, and also in the Clancy Lewis Arboretum. And you can work ornamental grasses in with perennial flowers, and they can look very nice. You just have to get the right ones for the right situation.
And so best thing to do is go online to look them up and
mm-hmm,
figure out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is there much care?
Ornamental grasses don't require much care. Basically, after they've been planted, you might fertilize them lightly. You don't need to fertilize them that much. They don't have any pest problems to speak of. They have to be cut down. I used to have a very large ornamental grass, and I used to just burn it down because the grass growing point was low enough to where it wasn't damaged by burning. But you can see there could be some inherent problems with that, especially if it's close to a building. So right. You don't want to burn down your ornamental grasses.
But you don't plant these kind of grasses to mow.
No, they're not to mow. They're strictly for looking at.
Right, okay.
And you see them a lot of times in commercial landscapes because they're very low maintenance.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I kind of like that idea. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what else do we need to do in November for our gardens?
Well, I think we've covered most of the things. In the perennial gardens in November, if you haven't cut things down, you want to do that. And
so when you have a perennial, like I've got some black-eyed Susan, some daisies and whatever, and you know, then there's these tall, dead stems. So you go in and you cut them.
Cut those right down, usually as close to the ground as you can get them.
Okay.
And the reason for that is most of the perennials don't give you very much winter interest. They don't look all that good when they're dead in the landscape. So, again, it's something that you want to do because you never know how fast spring is going to come on you.
Mm-hmm.
And the garden doesn't look as good when the new stuff is growing up among the dead, mm-hmm. and it becomes much more difficult for you to go in there and clean it out. So it's better to get that done in the fall also. But you can wait until everything's dead, and it should be by mid to late November.
Okay. All right. All right, folks. Well, you've been listening to The Garden Guy, and Gary, you have a YouTube channel. If people want to get a hold of you, how do they contact you?
They can just go on any search engine and type in my name, Gary Heilig, and it's H-E-I-L-I-G, and they can get to my YouTube channel.
So you have, now if you go to your YouTube channel and they're looking up something, they can type in what they're especially looking for?
Well,
or just do a search engine?
If they do a type, say for instance they have a particular interest in something, they can type it, and if I have a video on that, usually they rank in the top ones, but not always.
Okay.
But what I have on my channel, you can just look at the videos in general, but I also have playlists by topics.
Oh, okay.
And so I'm constantly adding new stuff.
So what if somebody has a specific question they want to ask you? Is that something they can do?
Sure, they can. If they happen to be on my YouTube channel, they can leave a comment. And okay. I respond to every last one of them.
All right, folks. So
at least I can now.
Yeah. So if you have any questions you'd like to ask Gary, go to YouTube and type in Gary Heilig, and that's H-E-I-L-I-G. I-G.
Yeah.
H-E-I-L-I-G.
Right.
And Gary Heilig, and it'll pull up, and you can leave him a message there, and he will get back with you.
Or they can just email me. It's my last name at msu.edu for education. And I still answer people's emails.
Okay. All right. All right, folks. Well, this has been November. We hope this has been helpful to you. And we really enjoy Gary. He's full of knowledge, and we're so thankful that he's helping us here at Strong Tower Radio and has become our monthly garden guy. So, folks, you have a great day, and we will see you next month for the December issue of Gary, our Garden Guy.